Numbers chapter 6 consists of two major pieces. The first 21 verses establish the office of the Nazirite. And then the last 5 verses gives us what has come to be called the Aaronic blessing. We close with every service. And both subjects are certainly worthy of being given sufficient time, so that's what we're going to do. Now, this is the only place in the Torah where the Nazirite is specifically referred to, but we will encounter the Nazirite in a number of places in the Old Testament outside of the Torah. And we'll also see that it is still in operation in New Testament times, because Paul himself participates in a Nazirite ritual at the suggestion of James, the brother of Jesus, the leader of the Messianic Jews. This was to be as proof to other Jews that Paul approves of and honors and obeys the Torah, even though he believes Yeshua is the Messiah. And Nazirites figure into several important Bible stories. Samson, tribe of Dan, Samuel, alternately described as an Ephraimite and a Levite, and some say John the Baptist, which I have some doubts about, because he was a Levite, but it could well have been. Well, some claim Jesus was a Nazirite, but I see no evidence to support that notion, and every reason to say he certainly wasn't. And the main reason that Yeshua is sometimes called a Nazirite is a faulty Christian tradition born out of an error that's still prevalent. The error is that a Nazirite and a Nazarene are the same thing. Yeshua is called a Nazarene, but that's because he's from Nazareth, his hometown. But Nazareth has nothing to do with being a Nazirite. Isn't that nice? So, let's read the entire chapter 6 of Numbers together. If you've got a complete Jewish Bible, we'll start on page 152. Adonai said to Moses, "Tell the people of Israel, when either a man or a woman makes a special kind of vow, the vow of a Nazir, a Nazirite, consecrating himself to Adonai, he is to abstain from wine and other intoxicating liquor. He's not to drink vinegar from either source. He's not to drink grape juice. He's not to eat grapes or raisins. And as long as he remains a Nazir, a Nazirite, he is to eat nothing derived from a grapevine, not even the grape skins or the seeds. And throughout the period of his vow as a Nazirite, he's not to shave his head until the end of the time for which he has consecrated himself to Adonai, he's to be holy. Until that time, he's to let the hair on his head grow long. And throughout the period for which he has consecrated himself to Adonai, he is not to approach a corpse. He's not to make himself unclean, even for his father, mother, brother, or sister when they die, since his consecration to God is on his head. Throughout the time of his being a Nazir, he is holy for Adonai. And if someone next to him dies very suddenly, so that he defiles his consecrated head, then he's to shave his head on the day of his purification. He's to shave it on the 7th day. And on the 8th day, he's to bring 2 doves or 2 young pigeons to the Kohen, the priest, at the entrance to the tent of meeting. And the priest prepare one of them as a sin offering, the other as a burnt offering, and thus make atonement for him, inasmuch as he sinned because of the dead person. That same day, he's to reconsecrate his head. He is to consecrate to Adonai the full period for his being a Nazirite by bringing a male lamb in its first year as a guilt offering. Previous days will not be counted because his consecration became defiled. This is the law for a Nazirite. When his period of consecration is over, he is to be brought to the entrance to the tent of meeting, where he will present his offering to Adonai. 1 male lamb in his first year without defect as a burnt offering, 1 female lamb in his first year without defect as a sin offering, and 1 ram without defect as peace offerings. a basket of matzah, loaves made with fine flour mixed with olive oil, unleavened wafers spread with olive oil, their grain offering and their drink offerings. The priest is to bring them before Adonai, offer his sin offering and his burnt offering, and his ram as a sacrifice of peace offerings to Adonai with the basket of matzah, unleavened bread. The priest will also offer the grain offering and drink offering that go with the peace offering. The Nazirite will shave his consecrated head at the entrance of the tent of meeting, take the hair removed from his consecrated head, and put it on the fire under the sacrifice of peace offerings. When the ram has been boiled, the priest is to take its shoulder, one loaf of matzah from the basket, one unleavened wafer, and place them in the hands of the Nazirite after he has shaved his consecrated head. The priest is to wave them as a wave offering for Adonai. This is set aside for the priest, along with the breast for waving and the raised up thigh. And following that, the Nazirite may drink. This is the law for the Nazirite who makes a vow before his offering to Adonai for his being a Nazirite, in addition to anything more for which he has sufficient means. In keeping with whatever vow he makes, he must do it according to the law of the Nazirite. Adonai said to Moses, speak to Aaron and to his sons and tell them that this is how you are to bless the people of Israel. You are to say to them, Be'erecha Adonai be'ishmerecha, Yair Adonai panav alecha be'chanecha, Isha Adonai panav alecha be'ashem lecha shalom. In this way you are to put my name on the people of Israel so that I will bless them. Okay, in the first couple of verses, we discover the first important attribute of a Nazirite. One becomes a Nazirite how? By taking a vow. The second important attribute is that both men and women can become Nazirites. So when we see it say he's to do this and he's to do that, it's just using a neutral sexual term. It's all. But now I'll tell you that as often as happens in the Bible, things change over the years. And the office of the Nazirite, who could be one, how long of a term a person could remain a Nazirite, what their obligations and duties were, and so on, that evolved over the centuries. Now let me use that comment as a reminder. While what we read in the Bible is the truth, that doesn't mean that everything that happens in the Bible is God approved. For instance, we read of the Israelites building a golden calf and then worshiping it. It's true. Did God approve of it? It wasn't a godly thing that was being dealt with in the golden calf fiasco. Now, that particular apostasy was spoken of in Scripture as wrong, and terrible consequences were meted out to those who participated in it. So it's not too tough for a reader to know that evil was occurring. But at other times in the Word, we'll read about some event, and little or no information is given as to whether this was necessarily a good thing or a bad thing. We're left to discern whether it was a good thing or a bad thing according to our understanding of the Torah. An understanding we're supposed to already possess. In other words, it is assumed from our knowing God and knowing his commandments and from our reading the context of the story, whether the point of the story is to commend a good act or to decry a bad one. So what a Nazirite was and what a Nazirite did was not the same a few hundred years after it was established by Moses. And what we read here in Numbers doesn't really match the way a Nazirite operated in Samson's day, nor later on in Samuel's day, nor later still in Paul's day. That's not because God changed anything. Men change things. In Numbers 5, where we dealt with the water ordeal of the suspected adulterous wife, God-ordained commandment, I told you that after the death of Christ, a very influential rabbi declared that this practice, the water ordeal practice of the law of God, was to be abolished. Now, was this rabbinical decision a reflection that God was changing something? He was abolishing one of his own laws and using a man to do it? Of course not. This was a man changing something he thought ought to be changed due to current circumstances. And these circumstances greatly troubled him, as they should have. Did this rabbi do this with an evil intent? No. From an earthly perspective, maybe even in a sense from a heavenly perspective, he was doing the right thing. Because the whole matter of dealing with adultery had become twisted and perverse. Men skated, women were persecuted for no other reason than men just got tired of their wives. And then by declaring that they suspected their wives of being unfaithful, got a quickie divorce, and could be congratulated for their piety by the Jewish religious authority to boot. In other words, the laws of adultery had become a legitimized fraud, the only possible criminal. And an act of adultery was now a woman. And a similar line of evolution of practice and custom occurred with the office of the Nazarite. Now, I tell you this because some of you have heard me speak in other lessons that there were two kinds of Nazarites, perpetual and for life. And perpetual, despite the name, referred to a Nazarite who took a vow for a specified period of time and then was a Nazarite no more. After that time limit. A Nazarite for life meant that. He was born as a Nazarite, he died as a Nazarite, meaning that it was his mother that made him a Nazarite while he was still in the womb. Now the thing is, there is no such commandment of God in the scriptures that establishes the offices of Nazarite for life. We'll read about it, but that just means that that practice existed. Not that it was a God-ordained practice, they just did it. And what gets established here in number 6 is the law of the perpetual Nazarite, which means that this person is a Nazarite only for a time and usually for a very specific purpose. I'm not going to be using the term perpetual now any further because it's totally confusing to apply it to this. I mean, it is to me anyway. And I think for you, perpetual means it never ends. Now, why some scholars coined that term, perpetual Nazarite, to indicate a temporary Nazarite, I don't know. I don't like it. But the Nazarite referred to in number 6 is temporary. And there appears to be no biblical contemplation at all of a thing called a Nazarite for life. Now, one good question might be, why would somebody want to be a Nazarite? And the answer is generally that someone would swear an oath to God that if God would grant some kind of special favor to them, like maybe cure them of the disease or restore their wealth, or if she was a woman, that she would give birth to a son or save her family from an enemy, something like that, then in return, that person would turn their life over to God for service to him, at least for a time. Now, it did take very long before a person offering to become a Nazarite became such a casual thing as it became part of a bet. For instance, you know what, if that guy over there in 17th, oh, I'll be a Nazarite. And we learned from Jewish records that sometimes priests would preside over the sacrificial offerings of hundreds of Nazarites at a time. So many people do it. And we see Paul in the New Testament books of Acts joining with 4 men who must have in some way violated their Nazarite vows, and so they had to be purified. Turn with me to Acts chapter 21. Acts chapter 21. Acts chapter 20. And we're going to look at verses 20-28. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it starts on page 1390. Acts 21, we're going to start at verse 20. On hearing it, they praised God, but they also said to him, "You see, brother, how many tens of thousands of believers there are among the Judeans, and they are all zealots for the Torah. Now, what they have been told about you," talking about Paul, "is that you are teaching all the Jews living among the Goyim, among the Gentile nations, to apostatize from Moses, telling them not to have a Brit Milah, circumcision ceremony, for their sons, and not to follow the traditions. What then is to be done? They will certainly hear that you've come, so do what we tell you. We have four men who are under a vow. Take them with you, be purified, and pay the expenses connected with them having their head shaved. Then everyone will know that there's nothing to these rumors which they have heard about you, but that on the contrary, you yourself stay in line and keep the Torah. However, in regard to the Gentiles who have come to trust in Yeshua, we all joined in writing them a letter with our decision that they should abstain from what had been sacrificed to idols, from blood, from what is strangled, and from fornication. The next day, Paul took the men and purified himself along with them and entered the temple to give notice of when the period of purification would be finished and the offering would be made for each of them. The 7 days were almost up when some unbelieving Jews from the province of Asia saw him in the temple, stirred up a crowd and grabbed him. "Men of Israel, help," they shouted. "This is the man who goes around teaching everybody things about against the people and against the Torah and against this place. And now he's even brought some Gentiles into the temple and defiled this holy place." This is obviously, if you know the Torah, about four Nazarites. And if you know the Torah, which the New Testament assumes you do, this is specifically about four men who had apparently been defiled somewhere or another during their Nazarite vow. Now we know this because what we see them doing is entering a 7-day period of purification that involves purchasing the proper sacrifices and having their head shaved. And while shaving one's head was also the procedure at the end of a vow, a 7-day period of purification was not required, so far as we know. We're told that Paul also had his head shaved, and he went through the purification procedures right along with these men. This could only mean one thing. Paul had undertaken the vow of a Nazarite. It was not contemplated, let alone permitted, that somebody should join others in purification rituals just to show sympathy or some kind of solidarity. This was a deadly serious business. What I'm saying is this wasn't some act or some performance that Paul was putting on. And part of the reason that James the Just had Paul do this was because Paul was going to be walking around Jerusalem bald-headed now. A sure sign that he had undergone a Nazarite ritual. Everybody knew what that bald head meant. He'd be a walking billboard to the effect that Paul followed the laws of Moses, even though he also believed that Yeshua was the Messiah. And we even see another time in which Paul unmistakably is at the end of a Nazarite vow he had personally taken. We find that in Acts 18. In verse 18 of Acts 18, it says, "And Paul, having remained many days longer, took leave of the brethren and put out to sea for Syria, and with him were Priscilla and Aquila. In Kenchrea, he had his hair cut, for he was keeping a vow." We can also know that a good many details have been left out in the account of Paul and having his hair cut. Because a Nazarite vow is supposed to end at the temple, and the hair itself was to be offered as a sacrifice. Burned up. He had his hair cut in Kenchrea, not Jerusalem. Now possibly it had his hair trimmed a bit, then later went to Jerusalem, had his head shaved, and perhaps in this era, rabbinic, when there was so much of a diaspora, Jews were spread out all over the place, right? That the rabbinic law allowed those Jews who were dispersed throughout the Roman Empire, who had taken the Nazarite vow, to cut their hair, shave their heads at some other location. We don't know for sure. Probably a good analogy as to what a Nazarite amounted to is that they were the monks and the nuns, so to speak, of the Hebrew religion. And unlike the Levite priests, who were born into lifelong service to God, a Nazarite was just any ordinary Israelite who made a personal choice. He or she volunteered to dedicate themselves wholly to God and unto his service for a specified period of time. But biblically speaking, a person set apart for service to God was a priest. So did becoming a Nazarite mean that a person had become a priest? Generally, no. A priest had to come from a very specific bloodline that descended from Aaron. And by all appearances, it seems intended that the God-ordained establishment of the office of the Nazarite actually excluded Levites from taking the Nazarite vow. This is implied in the opening statement in verse 1, which is, tell the people of Israel. See, Levites were no longer counted as among the people of Israel. They had been set aside, just as they had gone through their own separate census, and later on we'll find they'll even get their own territory in the Promised Land. So as of now, if the Levites were to be a part of this Nazarite office, God should have said, tell the people of Israel and the sons of Aaron, because two separate groups now, something like that. Now, we will find implications later on in the Bible, outside of the Torah, that some Levites did take on the vow of a Nazarite. Why they would do that is mysterious. This is probably another one of those non-God-ordained changes we discussed that occurred sort of spontaneously in Hebrew society, or it was that some tribes observed the law, others didn't, or it was that non-priest Levites, ordinary Levites that weren't allowed to be priests, were allowed to make Nazarite vows to become more priest-like. Something like that, perhaps. Well, anyway, verses 3 through 6 gives us the main attributes of a Nazarite, whether they were male or female. First, they are not only to abstain from strong drink, they cannot drink wine. In fact, they can't eat grapes or partake in any kind of a grape product. Grapes in any form are off limits. We'll talk more about it. Second of all, they are not to cut their hair during the time of the vow. And third, they are prohibited from touching a dead body. And what we find in essence is that a Nazarite, by means of his vow and his following these three basic and straightforward requirements, is given an equal status to a priest, even though a Nazarite is not a priest. And of course, over time, as tradition started to play more and more of a role in Judaism, rules started piling up about the requirements for a Nazarite. And as one expects of man-made rules and doctrines, the rules changed over time. So in various parts of the Bible, we'll see some Nazarite prohibitions lifted, others added, but none of these were God things. They were men things. Now, two of the three attributes listed in Numbers 6, 3 through 8 are very similar to what is required of priests. But if we look more closely, the Nazarite requirement is actually more stringent than that for a priest. A priest can certainly drink wine. And in fact, he does during some of the rituals, although he is prohibited from drinking wine as a beverage during the periods before he comes on duty. A Nazarite can't drink wine at all. He can't even sample the source of wine, grapes. Priests could not touch dead bodies, but they could tamper to their deceased parents, their grandparents, their spouses, their children. Nazarites weren't to touch a corpse under any circumstances. And those included close family. So in some ways, the requirements upon the Nazarite even approach that of the high priest. But in one way, we find that Nazarites had to do things in kind of an opposite fashion of the priests. Priests were not allowed to have long hair. Nazarites weren't allowed to trim their hair. So the office of a Nazarite was very unique among the Israelites. Well, why this prohibition against eating hairs? As usual, we're not directly told. Some Jewish scholars think they know why. I must admit, it sounds pretty credible and it fits the God patterns that we've discussed in the past. First of all, Israel is often symbolized by the grapevine. The idea is that in every Sabbath year, every seventh year, the land of Israel is consecrated to the Lord. The fields aren't harvested. The land is not tilled. And as concerns our study, vineyards are not to be tended. Not only must grapes be left on the vines to rot, even the much necessary twice yearly pruning of the vines was suspended during the sabbatical year. So just as the Nazarite is set apart and set aside for God for a certain time, during that time, the Nazarite symbols the quintessential purpose of Israel, holy and set apart for Yahweh. And the purpose of the Sabbath year is to symbolize that holiness and that set-apartedness of Israel. Therefore, just as the grapevines can't be touched, no grapes harvested during the sabbatical year, so Nazarites are not to touch or eat grapes during the term of their vow. In fact, the word Nazir, from which we get the word Nazarite, came to be used as the term to be used for pruning grapevines. So you see this close connection between the grape and wine prohibition requirements for the Nazarites and then the treatment of the grapes and the grapevines. Now, there are some mistaken impressions about Nazarites, so let's clear them up. Nazarites weren't supposed to be some kind of weird hermits that went off to eat locusts and honey and live out in the desert like John the Baptist. If the Baptist was a Nazarite, the locusts and honey that he ate and the generally solitary life he led had no part of it. Nazarites had no special food prohibitions apart from eating grapes. Further, they could marry, so celibacy wasn't part of the deal. They were perfectly allowed to wear normal clothing. They generally continued to hold normal jobs. They worked at everyday crafts. The thing that marked them as different, more than anything else, was the wild hair that would eventually result. Otherwise, they remained fully part of typical Israeli society. Now, I have some serious doubts that John the Baptist was a Nazarite. The Bible never calls him a Nazarite. The assumption that he was a Nazarite comes from his mother, Elisheba, vowing that she would not drink wine while John was in the womb, and that she would insist on Yochanan's, that's John's real Hebrew name, he would never drink wine or strong drink, yayin or char. And the other assumption is because he was said to have long hair. Well, I got news for you. Nazarites weren't the only Jews in that era to have wild or long hair or to abstain from wine or strong drink. One well-known group who did the exact same thing were called Rechabites. And we find mention of the Rechabites in the book of Jeremiah, as Jeremiah takes some Rechabites to the temple and offers them wine to drink, but they decline on account of their family tradition that they are descended from Jethro, Moses' father-in-law. And part of their tradition included not growing grapes, not even planting seeds of any kind, for they had to live in tents. So while they abstained from grapes, it was simply family tradition stemming from an apparently unknown reason. Essentially, they determined to live like the Bedouin. And other extra-biblical records indicate that they allowed their hair to grow very long. But John, by John the Baptist's day, a lot of traditions had eroded. Many groups and individuals were railing at the corrupt priesthood and the spiritless, hollow religion that many were now practicing, and that led to all kinds of cults and reactions. And asceticism was on the rise, meaning that many Jews were forsaking the comforts of life and community and attempting to get closer to God by means of self-denial and self-imposed poverty. The essence of Dead Sea Scroll fame were just one of many groups like this. And there's a lot of evidence that John the Baptist, at the very least, had frequent contact with the essence. And quite possibly was himself a formal member of the essence. John, by all accounts, was an ascetic. He lived out in the wilderness, was apparently a very strange figure. He ate a restricted diet, he wore sackcloth all the time. He never cut his hair. We would have found hundreds of individuals, probably thousands, who were just like John in their appearance in that day, because that was the persona of many of those who chose this ascetic lifestyle. And in the hills surrounding the desert oasis of Ein Gedi, if you've ever been there, there are scores of small caves where some of these loners lived for extensive periods of time. And another reason to doubt that Yochanan the Immerser was a Nazirite is that he was already a Levite by ancestry. And by the law of Moses, the office of Nazirite wasn't open to Levites. Now, this wasn't a disadvantage, though. Rather, it was simply avoiding needless duplication. Levites were already set apart for lifetime service to God, whether they were priests or just blue-collar temple workers. John would have been a set-apart Levite no matter under what circumstances he was born. The vow of John not drinking wine might have been more prophetic of Yeshua announcing he would not drink wine after his fateful Passover night, until he drank new wine with his disciples, more than an indication that he was Nazarene. Well, anyway, now it may well be that parts of a kind of modified Nazarite vow were employed in different eras. And when one looks at the Talmud and at the Mishnah, you find all sorts of different rules coming from the different rabbis that lived in different times about being a Nazirite. Even Samson, in the book of Judges, who is described forthrightly as a Nazirite for life, he didn't seem to pay very much attention to the Nazirite restrictions of number 6, other than what concerned his hair. He certainly did everything possible not to serve God until the last few moments of his life. So we have to be careful in assigning various biblical characters that would come centuries after the law of number 6 to the title of Nazirite, like it's spoken of here. Abstaining from wine and strong drink was not the sure sign of Nazirite, nor was even wearing long hair. Well, as we discussed earlier, the Hebrew word that we translate as Nazirite is Nazir. And since Hebrew is what's called a root word language, that is, it takes a word and then you change the vowel sounds and you add or subtract a consonant and it broadens or narrows the meaning of the word. But we're going to see several Hebrew word offshoots from Nazir, and they're quite interesting in their use in the Bible, very instructive. The base root word Nazir literally means set apart, or it can mean pruned. So literally translated, the person who takes the vow is not called a Nazirite. They're called a set-apart person or a pruned-away person. And whereas Nazir, N-A-Z-I-R, is a positive term that indicates being spiritually consecrated to God, the Nazirites must also Nazar, N-A-Z-A-R, be separated from grapes, separated in the negative sense. They're prohibited from grapes. Further, there's the word nezer, N-E-Z-E-R, which literally means shoot or branch. It's the term used for the unpruned grapevine. But the term is also used to denote the high priest's glorious headpiece, that one with the golden band around it, as well as the long hair of a Nazirite. So when we read these passages in Hebrew, we see the obvious parallel between the head covering of the high priest, his special hat, and the Nazirite's head covering. Remember, we were told, what we just read, it was all about his head, his consecrated head, and that long hair was the sign of his consecrated head. Nazir, Nazir, Nazar. So you see how these Hebrew words all work together to help us understand the relationship now between priests, grapevines, and Nazirites, and of the Nazirites being consecrated for God. Verses 9 through 12 talk at length about the Nazirite, male or female, being made ritually unclean by coming near a corpse, actually contacting the body of a dead person wasn't necessary to defile a Nazirite. Simply being in the same room with a dead person was sufficient to contaminate and thereby cause to terminate the period of the Nazirite vow, meaning that after a 7-day period of purification, like what those four men plus Paul went through in Acts 21, the time frame of a Nazirite's vow started all over again. So you can imagine how fastidiously a Nazirite would avoid the dead. But over the years, the rabbis came up with several new defilements that a person could contract, causing them to have to repeat the period of the vow. I want to give you an example of this. Sometime just after Christ died, there was a person named Queen Helena, who was the wife of a king who ruled over a city-state up in Mesopotamia. She was a Gentile who had fairly recently converted to Judaism. And her son, who was the prince of her kingdom, was about to go off to war. So she made a vow that if her son would return home safely, she would become a Nazirite for 7 years. That was a pretty long period of time. He came back safe and sound, so she followed through and took on the vow of a Nazirite. Well, after the 7-year period was completed, she went to Jerusalem for the typical rituals to mark the ending of a vow, and some rabbis instructed her that she hadn't properly observed the Nazirite requirements and told her as a result, she had to start all over again. And she did. But near the end of her second 7-year period, she became impure. There's no record of exactly what caused the impurity. So she had to do yet another, almost 7 years. So all told, she was a Nazirite for something close to 21 years. But 14 of those years was due to her fouling up. At least that's what the rabbi said. There's a phrase at the end of verse 12 that's quite interesting. Almost all Bibles will say, just like our complete Jewish Bible does, the previous days will not be counted because his consecration became defiled. This is not a good translation. What the Hebrew says is the previous days of the Nazirite vow will not be counted because his nazir became defiled. His nazir is referring to the hair of the Nazirite. Among the Hebrews and other Middle Eastern cultures, the liver and the kidneys are thought of in the same way as we today think of the heart. In other words, love was not of the heart. You experienced love in your kidneys. I love you with all my kidneys. It just doesn't sound very good. Thought processes took place not in the brain, but in the heart. The liver had a lot to do with where these deepest passions respond. Jealousy, anger, things like that. So the hair was another part of human anatomy that was seen as very important in Middle Eastern cultures. Hair was thought to be the seat of a man's vitality and his life force. Hair in the pagan world was often given as burnt offerings to the gods. Therefore, as the hair was thought to be the seat of life, then it was the hair that carried the defilement that a Nazirite might incur. And in the same way, the hair carried the purity then of one's life force. And when the Nazirite properly completed his vow period, his or her hair became shaved off the head and then burned up as an offering because it was considered as a clean and pure and holy thing. The hair of a defiled Nazirite, of course, was not offered to God. Depending on the era, it was either burned up in a common fire or was buried in the ground. We get the full ritual of the Nazirite, who's completed his vow, in verses 13 through 20. And in a nutshell, he brings the four main kinds of sacrifices: the burnt offering, grain offering, the peace, and the reparation offerings. It costs the Nazirite three lambs in total to end his vow. That's just a reminder of how costly it is when you make a decision to set apart yourself for the Lord. And after shaving his hair off, the ritual ends with the words, "After that, the Nazirite may drink wine again." Point is, he's released from his vow. Well, we're going to finish up today with this. The sixth chapter of Numbers ends with the awesome Aaronic blessing. Let's reread it. Evarecha Adonai v'yishmerecha, Yair Adonai panav alecha v'chonech, Yisha Adonai panav alecha, Yashem lecha shalom. Now, this blessing that immediately follows the law concerning the Nazirite has always been puzzling. What is clear, though, is that while the laws of the Nazirite are speaking to a few, the Aaronic blessing upon Israel is spoken collectively as a group. The blessing was spoken each day, immediately following the morning sacrifice. Actually, this blessing is a very early Hebrew poem. And one of the primary duties of the priests were to bless Israel. But this blessing lets all involved, the people and the priests, know that the priests are just conduits from the divine. They have no power to bless or to curse. They can just speak and remind the people of what God promises and what God does. Every place in our Bibles that this benediction says Lord or Adonai, the original Hebrew says Yud Hey Vav. That's not conjecture, it's just fact. Yehovah bless you. Yehovah shine his face upon you. Yehovah give you shalom. Blessing in our language and in Christianity is a very broad and inclusive term. But that's just because of our ignorance. Biblically speaking, blessing is quite specific in its meaning. Blessing is God bestowing upon his people the things that he counts as good for us. And when we look through Scripture, we find that blessing generally consists of good health, land, safety, sufficient food, children. Blessing is a verb. It involves action. God feeling kindly towards us is not blessing. We want him to feel favor towards us. That's not what blessing means. In the same way, love is a verb. Love may be the most understood and misappropriated word in the entire Bible. Ahav, love. For in the Hebrew, ahav, love, is not an emotion. It is literally an action, something you do. It's only in the Western Church of Gentiles that love has become a romantic, warm, internal, mushy feeling. certainly love has an emotional component. But just as James tells us that faith without action is no faith at all, so is love that has no tangible action no love at all. Would you want God to feel all warm and fuzzy for you, but not to give you tangibly what you need? Well, we're all in luck, because the act of blessing is the act of giving. And what is it he gives us? It says here in the Aaronic blessing that he blesses us with, meaning he actively gives to us protection, grace, and peace. In Hebrew, it's protection, grace, and shalom. See, shalom doesn't only mean peace. It means well-being in every sense. It means that God's near to you. It means his salvation has been made available to you. It means his sufficiency in all things is there for you, and it means a lack of war. And I just love this blessing. It sums up God's intention, his attitudes, his character, but notice that this blessing is aimed at Israel. This isn't a blessing for the whole world. It's only for those who make up the set-apart group that he calls my people. Israel and all those joined to Israel. That's never changed. It's only that instead of joining Israel by means of pledges and oaths and circumcision, one now joins Israel by means of faith in Yeshua HaMashiach, Jesus Christ. And that is the provision since about 30 AD, if a man wants God's blessing.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.